This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov. A lot of interesting things to talk about, but I wanted to just share with listeners a personal experience that I had yesterday, which gave me a lot of food for thought. I was in my office and they turned up a whole array of tubs of ice cream in the office. Someone decided to go out and buy all these different flavors of ice cream, and being addicted to ice cream as I am, that was a great thing for me. But I just wondered what had given incentive for all these ice cream tubs to be bought. And there was quite a significant story behind this. And the story is that a local ice cream shop had apparently a few days ago advertised publicly their ice creams online. The shop had been going through some tough times. It's a family-owned shop. The son had spent more than 200 days in the reserves in Miluim. He's the one who runs the shop, and they were trying to get things back on the road again. And so they went out and advertised their ice cream. And one of the things that they said about their ice cream is that it's kosher, that it abides by the Jewish requirements to keep things kosher, the contents, the way that it's prepared, not working on Shabbat, everything else that comes with being kosher. And as a result of that, they received a fine from the chief rabbinate of a few thousand shekels, because the chief rabbinate said that they're not entitled to say that their ice cream is kosher, because it's not under the supervision of the chief rabbinate's kashrut division. Right. And therefore, they are the ones who hold the exclusivity over anybody in Israel's right to talk about or to advertise that their food is kosher.
Right.
And it turns out that the ice cream shop felt justified in saying that their ice cream is kosher because it's under the supervision of an organization called Tzohar. And they supervise it, and they've decided that it's kosher, except that the chief rabbinate has this exclusivity over the word kosher, and therefore the fine was implemented on them right away within a few hours. And they were forced to remove the reference to the fact that the ice cream is kosher. As a result of that, this story went viral. And amongst other people, one of my work colleagues decided to go in to support the shop. And I think potentially this story could have done them more help in terms of promoting their business than anything else. But I think therein lies a very, very substantial discussion and argument about the way in which things are done here, the way that the chief rabbinate operates, the fact that your chief rabbinate is under the control of the ultra-Orthodox parties, the fact that this organization called Tzohar, which is run by a council of 42 modern Orthodox rabbis, which is an inclusive organization, which adheres to all the principles of Jewish law and of halakha, including under their auspices, they have marriages and they have conversions and they have supervision for kosher food and many other organizations. And they are inclusive. They are trying to reach out to people who might not necessarily be Orthodox. They might be traditional. They might be secular. They might not even be halakhically Jewish, but they reach out to them in order to be inclusive. And this organization is being systematically excluded because of the monopoly that the ultra-Orthodox community have over the chief rabbinate and over the declaration, their ability to declare that things are kosher. I went in and looked at Tzohar's website. I didn't realize that they're an organization that's founded in the wake of the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin back in 1995. They've got some incredible objectives, the way that they look at things. They try to be as inclusive as possible. Their mission statement is fantastic. People who are interested in Torah want to support them. I would very much encourage it, because I think that this is an organization which attempts to bind and connect people rather than to divide. And I think that at this stage, you know, in the way that things are going right now, we're looking to somehow connect rather than to exclude people because they don't quite fall into line. So that's a little bit of a rant that I have for the day, which all started with a delicious bowl of ice cream.
What flavor?
It was their special edition, which didn't really have a name, but it was kind of like cookies and cream with a little bit of chocolate added. I don't really know what it was, right, but I went for the special edition.
Brilliant. Absolutely fascinating. And an interesting bigger picture, which is really what you were talking about in that story. The moving very far away from anything pleasant like ice creams. The bodies of two hostages were recovered yesterday from Gaza by the IDF. Who are the hostages?
So we know the name of one of the hostages, Yair Yaakov. His body was found in the Khan Yunis area. There are some slightly conflicting stories about whether he was actually killed on October the 7th and his body abducted into Gaza, or whether in fact he was killed by Hamas subsequent to that. He was 59 years old at the time of his abduction from Kibbutz Nir Oz. Members of his family were also abducted at the same time, and they were released in one of the hostage releases. Unfortunately, Yair was not to be, and finally the IDF did manage to find his body during the course of yesterday, which was extricated from the Khan Yunis area, was identified properly. And as much as this is very, very painful for us to bring home bodies, and as much as we want to be focused on bringing live hostages home, and there are live hostages to be brought home, and of course they are a much higher priority, I don't think that we can underestimate the importance of also bringing home those who have not survived. We need to bring all of them home. And of course, we are delighted that Yair, even though unfortunately not alive, will finally be brought to rest on Kibbutz Nir Oz, which is where his home was and where he should be. He leaves behind a wife and two sons, one 16 years old and one 12 years old. And it's a very, very tragic story indeed. The second body has yet to be publicly identified. We understand that the family have been advised of who it is, and they have requested, at least for now, that the name not be publicly known. But again, our condolences to that family, and we feel the heartbreak, even though we don't know who the individual is, we feel the heartbreak of this tragedy that has been fallen. That family that has been fallen, that community, and has befallen all of us, because we all feel it very, very emotionally indeed. And now there remain 53 hostages in Gaza, day 615 of their incarceration. And of course, we are very desperate to bring home those who are alive, but no less those, unfortunately, who are no longer alive, and who deserve to be brought home and laid to rest properly in the way that respects them and respects their families, and that gives us all the closure that we need around their particular incident.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing, because there really is a great yet terrible sense of relief that the number at least goes down. The number of hostages goes down. It's just a very, very painful exercise and process. The moving on to something also I think quite painful. The Knesset dissolution bill failed to pass yesterday. That was after the ultra-Orthodox factions reached a framework agreement with the government regarding the draft of ultra-Orthodox youth. Do we know what this agreement entails?
Well, We don't have all the details of the agreement, and we understand that some of the details still need to be worked out. But the agreement really involves two or three different aspects. First of all, the fact that ultra-Orthodox youth need to go to the army, and therefore there will be certain requirements set in terms of the number of youth who join the army each year. There will be a framework that will require the ultra-Orthodox community to support the fact that their youth will attend the army. So there is that already that objective, that framework that's been laid out in terms of making sure that at least a certain number of people will be drafted to the military each year. And that will be an increasing number over time. So initially a relatively small number and then growing over time. And I guess that the plan is that ultimately all ultra-Orthodox youth will be required to draft to the army, whether it be to formally to the IDF or whether it be to some sort of a national service framework, if that's more appropriate, but that they will all be required. So that is the first element of this agreement. And I think that those kind of objectives were relatively well understood. Those mechanisms were relatively well drafted even before the events of yesterday. The problem was, how does this get policed? How does this law really have teeth? In other words, what happens if those objectives are not met? What happens if individuals who are drafted fail to turn up? What then? And this was really where the sticking point was about to what extent sanctions can be leveled, not only on the individual, but indeed even on the ultra-Orthodox community in general, on those who are making this agreement. They need to have some responsibility to make sure that the community buys into it. And it's quite interesting, some of the sanctions that have been mentioned as part of the framework, nothing's been finally agreed, but have certainly been mentioned. So some of them include a suspension of the individual's driver's license and restrictions on them leaving the country, and setting up a special committee in order to review exceptional cases. But the point is that if others who are not within the ultra-Orthodox community to fail to turn up for the draft, they potentially face a criminal trial and jail for not turning up to the draft. So we need to just contrast the different expectations that are being set, that this law doesn't say, well, those individuals who don't turn up are subject to the same rules as everybody else. That's not the case. They have special sanctions that are being agreed upon, those that I mentioned previously. But there are potentially even greater sanctions than that, including subsidies to ultra-Orthodox community centers. Some of the daycare centers, some of the kindergartens will be, their subsidies, their government subsidies will be reduced and will then only increase back to the original levels, assuming that all of the objectives of this particular agreement have been met. So there are sanctions that are at an individual level, some of them at a more community-wide level, in order to try and make sure that everybody buys into this. Now, I know that a lot of people are saying this is too little too late, that this is really not enough, and that if other Israeli youth are required to draft without any issue, and if they don't turn up, they go to jail, the same laws should be applied uniformly to everybody. And that is true. That is true. I absolutely agree with that. However, I think we need to find a way to get there. And I don't think that we can just jump from one extreme to another in one step. I think we need baby steps along the way. I think we need to get moving. We need to get closer to the objective rather than just to say it's all or nothing. So I very much support the idea of creating a separate framework, a special framework, which has the obvious objective of progression. We need to see that it's going somewhere. It doesn't remain static. It changes each year to get the ultra-Orthodox youth closer to where everybody else. And there needs to be some sort of a timetable which says over 5 or 10 years or whatever it is, ultimately they will fall into the same basket as everybody. So the first thing is, of course, that the dissolution bill of the Knesset was not supported in the end by the ultra-Orthodox factions and therefore failed quite easily because it would have needed their support in order to bring the government under threat. But we do now have some sort of a framework. And I suspect that the courts might not like this framework. The court might say it's not enough. It's not uniform. It doesn't apply to everybody uniformly. But I personally feel that it's progress and that we need to respect the fact that we can't get the whole go the whole hog until we've made those steps in between.
That is Anthony's perspective. I'd love yours, 061-895-1019. Anthony, there's been a lot of very, very concerning news around Iran, the evacuation of some of the U.S. facilities. But a way often to tell these things, to tell how serious it is how is Israel responding? Have they limited public events? Are they asking people to be prepared for something? Is there anything happening within Israeli society?
There have been no formal statements from any of the government agencies, from any of the military or security agencies to say, stock up, get ready, buy water, buy cans of tuna. Nobody has made any statements about anything. Now, just bearing in mind that we are, in any event, in a relative state of readiness. In other words, our bomb shelters are ready. We visited them recently. They might not necessarily be ready for a long visit, because generally what we've done up until now is like 10 minutes at a time and then come out. So we haven't had the need for water and food and sleeping over in the most part, or, you know, toilet facilities or anything like that. So nothing formally is being said, although there is definitely a discussion, informal discussion. Everybody's talking about what might happen if we need to get a little bit more comfortable for longer periods of time in the bomb shelter. But obviously, with the U.S. government issuing a formal notification to non-essential staff members at their embassies in the Middle East to evacuate immediately, and many other countries have also said to their foreign nationals, get out of the area of the Middle East, get out of Bahrain, get out of Saudi Arabia, get out of wherever you are, get out of Iraq if you're there, whatever there have been, these sort of quite, I don't want to call it panic-stricken, but almost urgent notifications for people to evacuate the area. So the word in the Israeli press is that we are nearer than we have ever been to a strike against Iran. Some people are thinking it could even be over the weekend. Maybe by the time I speak to you guys on Monday, we'll have a lot to talk about in terms of fireworks that have happened over the weekend. Very, very, very difficult to assess. And also very difficult for me to say, I'd love to see this happen, or I would hate to see this happen, because each of those positions has significant implications. Of course, if we attack against Iran, we've been wanting to do this for ages to get rid of their nuclear facility. The implications are we might come under significant attack ourselves. If we don't attack Iran, it just delays this. It just gives them the message that they can continue to enrich uranium freely and produce nuclear weapons. So I don't know where I stand on this issue right now, but maybe by the time we get to Monday, I'll have a clearer view. So I'll just leave listeners with that. And of course, I'm sure everybody will weigh in with their own views. But I think it's promising to be a relatively interesting weekend for us.
Let's hope everybody remains safe and that the outcome is the best one. 801 Anthony Reich, thank you as always. Wishing you a peaceful weekend, a Shabbat Shalom. And we can catch you, we'll catch you on Monday morning at 7:45.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.